We have made a good deal here one time or another about the importance of checking back to ideas that have been held at other periods in our culture and have gradually lost popularity. One of the reasons why we feel that reviewing of this kind is substantially good is because today especially many of our convictions are not the direct result of the exhaustion of older concepts, but have arisen from the arbitrary dismissal of them. As this dismissal has been largely the result of what we call the scientific attitude, which is rather critical and skeptical of any possible superphysical or metaphysical type of phenomena, we feel that some of the modern conclusions may be arbitrary, based upon prejudice or disbelief, rather than upon sound investigation. We are perfectly justified in rejecting that which is disproven. But we are not really fully justified in total rejection in areas where our own knowledge is extremely limited. Until we have grown wiser than we are, may pay, therefore, to see what other people have known and what they have thought on subjects of concern to us. We have already mentioned that in the ancient world, dreams were regarded as a legitimate phase of man's life. It was simply assumed that the dream world was real, that the individual going to sleep passed into another dimension of existence, and that in this dimension of existence, he had certain distinct experiences. And these experiences, when brought through in a confused or imperfect manner back into waking consciousness, might be fragmentary, even inconsistent, and still have a meaning that is essentially true or essentially valid. Now, we are not inclined to think today of the dreamer's world as anything more than perhaps an area of psychological function in which the individual releases, through the relaxation of his objective faculties, his own interior subconscious content. This does, however, point out two possibilities. The first, that there may be some validity somewhere in the belief that man sleeping changes world. And there may also be a valid concept underlying the idea that if sleep represents a gradual retiring into the subjectivity of our own inner life, but there may be more in this inner life than psychology as yet has been willing to admit. Let us think through for a moment the Chinese and Greek and even the old Egyptian belief that in sleep the soul of man passes into the after-death state. That sleeping is in reality a time of focusing of man's consciousness on another level or plane of function. That therefore, that the sleep world is a kind of place or condition to which individuals temporarily pass. During this sleep experience, they have certain temporary experiences which parallel the after-death state. The Egyptians, who were very thoughtful about this, have given us quite an exhaustive concept of the afterlife. They have implied, for example, that in the afterlife, the individual is punished or rewarded according to certain merits or demerits. Punishment consists of a process of cleansing, similar to the concept of the Christian purgatory, which merely means, really, a place of cleansing or of the purging of the life of its various negative attributes. In the underworld of the Egyptians, the soul is therefore constantly being tried or tested in the great court of the gods, the principal episode being the psychostasia, or the weighing of the soul. The Egyptians tell us this, therefore, that death is a process by which consciousness is brought into the presence of punishment and reward. To a smaller degree, then, may not the sleep phenomena carry somewhat of this burden? Psychologists tell us that during sleep, the individual certainly comes face to face in dreams with phases or aspects of his own submerged personality. And the psychological dream is usually one of a basically corrective nature. It is a punishment experience. It is an experience in which the individual faces some phase of himself, which he rejects during his daily conscious life. Also in dream, that which is submerged or hidden from his awareness escapes from its place of hiding and comes again to confront him. Most psychological dreams tell us that there is something wrong with the person. This thing that is wrong may not be criminal or evil in that sense at all, but it is something which is not right, which is not normal, healthy, natural, and proper. And as we know that the average person does not live an entirely proper life, that he is not always right, and that his conduct is not always above reproach, even his own reproach. We can quite readily understand that the mistakes that he makes, the false beliefs that he holds, the unreasonable or unwise opinions which influence his conduct, that these could produce, and usually do produce, a psychological backlog that becomes locked in him, and which is available to him most directly, either in sleep or in what is called reverie, a process resembling sleep, in which the individual becomes relaxed or receptive to the impressions of his own psychic life. The Egyptians holding their position, then, might not be so different in their essential concepts from many of the opinions that we hold today. But because they put their thoughts into a highly theological language, we are inclined to regard their feelings as merely a survival of primitive religious doctrine. Actually, the fundamental point involved is that sleep and death, being aspects of one general condition, that they are phases of human existence in which punishment and reward play a distinct part. Now, in punishment, as far as the person is concerned, we know that anyone, and nearly everyone, can be punished by his own memory. But the things that we have done are never totally forgotten. And that the mistakes that we make, injuries that we cause, unhappiness due to us, All these leave markings in our remembrance. And these markings, in turn, may arise or be reactivated to give us pangs of conscience or to give us guilt mechanisms of one kind or another. If we block the memory of man, a large part of psychotherapy would be useless and unnecessary. It is memory that actually undoes us, forcing us to face the previous conduct of ourselves and to compare this conduct with its own consequences and the misfortunes which have ensued. Thus, the idea that the sleep life is a place of purging has some very definite validity. We know that dreaming existed long before men had any conscious knowledge of psychotherapy, that the dream preceded any formularized concept by means of which it could have been influenced into existence. The individual was not originally taught that his dreaming was important. He had the dreams and he felt their importance. And gradually from this feeling, he has developed his reaction to sleep phenomena in general. Presuming for a moment that it is possible that sleep is therefore a way of bringing the individual into more immediate realization of his own character. Perhaps in sleep, the individual must come nearer to living with himself than at any other time. Also, he comes in contact with a kind of self which he otherwise might never know to exist. In our daily objective lives, we are living largely by patterns, by pressures, and we are conscious because of a continual excitation of the central nervous system. If, therefore, we live forever objectively in a waking state, it is quite probable that many of our faults would never be corrected. That in some mysterious way, the sleep problem is not only important to us as a physical means of relaxation, but as a moral means of continuing the processes of adjustment by means of which our characters are brought into harmony with our ethical convictions. All of this is of comparatively slight meaning to most people today, but I think psychological procedures are indicating that it is essentially true that for one reason or another, the psychologist has hit upon the dream as one of his most valuable instruments. And he frequently follows procedures which are inclined to cause the patient to have significant dreams or to stimulate the dream processes. And under analysis, many people, most people, dream more frequently and more intensely than in the normal processes of living. Thus, analysis bringing with it a measure of thoughtfulness about self and its conduct. This type of thoughtfulness seems to increase the tendency for the patient to have more frequent and more meaningful dream experiences. We also think of the dream experience as one means of exhausting certain types of pressures. This might be quite valid in itself. It is one way in which the Hercules' ego can cleanse the stables as one of his 12 labors. This process of cleaning out the subconscious by bringing into objectivity all of its content is, to a measure, a way of attaining virtue. It is a process of gradually solving the inconsistencies of the inner experience. Outwardly, we are not necessarily logical or consistent in action, nor are we sufficiently observant to consciously record the various happenings that mark the day. In sleep, however, it is as though a judge sat upon a bench, weighing and estimating almost all of the processes by which our mental and emotional actions have been stimulated. Our motives are more carefully analyzed. The various secret desires or feelings that we have carefully hidden from other people are suddenly exposed to us. All things being equal, therefore, dreaming appears to arise especially in connection with a certain neurotic type of attitude. The individual who senses guilt, the individual who blames himself, or feels that some mysterious force operating through his own personality is injuring him, this kind of person most frequently dreams. Also, this person finds dreams more important to him. Many individuals down through history and in our time do dream and pay no more attention to the dream than into any other vision or mystery which comes to them. They assume that an occasional dream is natural, therefore they think very little about it. If, however, the person is introverted or inhibited, the very processes which make him think too much about himself also cause him to think too much about his dream. Thus the dream becomes increasingly important as he tries to understand it. And he nearly always tries to understand it in a negative way, as though it implied guilt of some kind or testified to some false attitude or error of conduct on his own part. Thus, as the Egyptians believed that there was a judge ruling over the dead, so there seems to be a judgment in dreams. The individual is placed under a condition in which he must listen to the verdict of a judge or jury. He is in a kind of court where he is being tried and where his various mistakes cause penalties or result in the imposing of appropriate penalties, so that the person is penalized in his sleep for the things that he does while he is awake. This would all fit into the general philosophic concept of the ancients on this matter. The Greeks had a somewhat different belief. In many instances, they associated the dream with the initiatory rites. This means that they in large agreed with the Egyptians, for the Egyptian regarded the after-death experience as a form of initiation into the mysteries of the blessed gods. The Greeks, rather more directly, more naturally, and somewhat less theologically, because of their very type of mind, assumed that the dream represented a highly, shall we say, intensified a way of passing through experiences. The dream gave the individual a greater sense of the meaningfulness of life. It helped him to experience life as initiation into the great mysteries of deity. In the dream state, therefore, the individual followed a ritual hardly less fantastic than that of the Eleusinian or Sabbatian rites. He proceeded to travel into the underworld. He went into the abode of Dis, or Hades, god of the dead. Here he beheld the ghosts of others performing incredible and mysterious tasks. And the ghost world, described by Homer and by other Greek poets, Hesiod, and in the plays of Sophocles and people of this kind, this ghost world is very close to the idea of a dream world, for it is inhabited by persons under some kind of compulsion, and these souls under compulsion perform all the fantastic duties or absurd actions which we find represented by Dante in his Inferno. Thus, to the Greek, the dream experience was a key to the waking experience. It revealed in a mysterious way the secret of our daily life. Therefore, man, by his sleep, solved the mystery of his waking hours and discovered the primary importance of events that might otherwise pass unnoticed. The gods of Greece were said to give their revelations in symbols. And nearly always, the dream symbolism has paralleled very closely the religious symbolism of ancient institutions. The Eleusinia and all the other rites taught by means of symbols. The disciple or the initiate passing through the ritual was expected to study these symbols, to become inwardly aware of their meaning, and to discover under the veiled truth the great mysteries which were concealed in allegory and legend and lore and rite and ceremony. Thus, to the Greeks, sleep was part of an acceptance into the temple or sanctuary of reality. To them, and to many others, in fact, sleep phenomena has been regarded as more valid than waking phenomena. Now, of course, our modern friends would probably consider that to be little better than an absurdity. But is it absurd? Does the psychologist, when he explores dream symbolism of a patient, discover in this dream experience that the patient possessed a knowledge greater than that which the patient consciously knows that he possesses? Is the dream more honest than our daily conduct? Does it reveal truth of which we are not consciously aware? If such is the case, then the dream is instructive. The dream does represent a valid source of knowledge. It represents a means of discovering value which might otherwise never be possible to us, because in the complexity of a waking consciousness, our sense of value is frequently distorted or in one way or another, confused. So perhaps the Greek has a point, namely that the dream is a valid source of knowledge. Also, experience has taught men from the very beginning that certain kinds of dreams were dreams of communication, and many of the world's choicest secrets have been discovered as the results of dreams. Some of the world's greatest disasters have been averted by dreams. A vast amount of knowledge that we now consciously hold came to us first as the result of sleep phenomena. I think if we remove from the history of knowledge all forms of scientific, philosophic, religious, cultural, artistic, or aesthetic, or even trade skills that had first been revealed by dreams, that we would be still in a rather primitive condition. Actually, most knowledge the ancients held came from the gods. But man was first instructed by divine beings. And this is little more than saying that this knowledge came to man not merely from his own experience, but by revelation. The dream is therefore a valid form of revelation and has always been so regarded. It has been present as an instrument of direct divine knowing among most ancient peoples. Even today, among primitive groups, the final emergences of life are met by the dream. When the individual is unable to secure any practical insight from ordinary means, he goes into meditation or prayer, which departs from the world, or seeks the assistance of some mystic, and there in the mystical trances and dreams and visions, he finds the concrete answers to problems which he cannot otherwise solve. Knowledge has come to man through the dream vision experience since the very beginning of his existence. The psychologist may agree that this is evidentially true, but he may hold the position that this is possible because the subconscious part of man is essentially wiser than the conscious. That this subconscious part has a skill that the conscious nature does not possess. Why might this be true? One answer could be very obvious. Most of the things that we do in life, we do to advance or for the advantage of our temporal objective state. The individual is selfish, unkind, cruel, gossipy, worrisome, angry, because these conditions are part of his objective waking way of life. They seem to be justified by the things that happen to him. They seem to be made necessary by the kind of world that he lives in. The question then arises, does this inner part, the subconscious part of man, this subjective self, does it have the same appetite? Does it have the same requirements, the same attitudes, and the same convictions? For instance, can the subjective part of man be bound to a creed, even though his conscious mind may be so bound? Will the objective part of man be able to free itself from the dogmatism of opinion as easily as this unconscious internal part? The answer to this appears to be that while the objective man is a conformist, the psychic being within us remains forever curiously individualistic. This psychic part of nature, of man's nature, does not become as conditioned by externals as does the objective consciousness of man. This may be due to a different distribution of sensory perception. For it is true that man's eyes, because of the peculiar relationship which they occupy to phenomena, have given man a great sense of material realities. Whereas the psychic life, observing things not by the eyes, but by some intuitive or internal measure of knowing, may not be so easily over-influenced, confused, or distorted in its judgment. Unless there was some part in man better than the parts we generally know, there could be no reason or excuse for true conscience. If the individual did not have a conflict arising between the compromises of his action and the principles which he inwardly holds to be true, he would probably have very few psychic disturbances. It is because somewhere in him there is a better self that he can come in conflict with this better self and therefore also derive from it the impetus to self-improvement. There has to be something that is stronger than what we are, or we would remain what we are. There has to be some factor in our life that is dissatisfied with our present conduct, or we will never improve. That which is dissatisfied with what we are seemingly always impels us to be better. Therefore, within this dissatisfied inner something, there must be a vision of betterness, a sense of betterness, even a knowing of betterness, superior to that with which we face daily life. The ancients, perhaps from this circumstance alone, contemplated the superiority of the soul over the body, and they further divided the soul itself into a higher or lower organ, declaring that the higher organ of the soul was by nature essentially more virtuous, more splendid, more contemplatively wise, more aware of reality than that part of the soul which, being immersed in matter, becomes the animator of the body. Consequently, we can see why the Hindus, the Greeks, the Egyptians, Persians, and most other people have sensed that the journey of man inward to communion with his own soul was essentially a journey in the direction of betterment, of improvement, of something nobler. That the soul of man within man was nearer to the divine than the objective faculty. Perhaps by being nearer to the divine, the Greeks would have told us that what is really meant is that this soul was closer to the understanding of the laws governing matter and mind and substance and essence than the objective faculty. That the soul had a superior power to cognize value. And that because of this, the soul is the better part of man. And that this better part is the natural shepherd or leader of the rest. That the soul is therefore the priest over the body. That the soul is a spiritualized being in comparison to the body, which seems to be a materialized aspect of the soul. If all these speculations are old, they are also surprisingly new because of this point that we have attempted to make, namely that almost all psychotherapy takes for granted that the disturbance to man's outer nature arises from the disturbance in his psychic life, and this disturbance is conflict. If the psychic life was identical with the objective life, there would be no reason for this conflict. If it knew no more than the objective faculty, there would be no reason for conflict. But if, as in the case of a family, a parent having a greater wisdom beholds in the child an action contrary to its good, it becomes the duty of this parent to in some way instruct or correct that child. It appears, therefore, that it is forever the duty of the psychic self to instruct or correct the body, the personality, and the objective mind. And where the body or the mind depart from ways of righteousness, the soul communicates its displeasure by a series of intensive symbolic experiences. Thus, perhaps the modern and the old meet. They are dealing with different words, but with essentially the same ideas. We have already analyzed or discussed at some length the reasons why the psychic life apparently is better able to reach man during sleep than at any other time. Because during this period, the objective dissenter is temporarily suspended. As Buddha points out, the machinery of the sensory perception, having ceased, man is relieved of the pressure of the appearances of things, and is therefore relieved of this feeling that most people have. What I see is true. If you can't fool me, I saw it with my own eyes. And the individual who says, these things I have seen, these things I have experienced on my own skin, these things which I do not like or which may not be happy are nevertheless true because I have recorded them. And I have recorded them exactly and precisely with the assistance of the sensory perception. The person saying this is in a highly defensive position. He is in a position in which he finds it necessary to live in conformity with these testimonies of things seen and heard and known through immediate contact. Yet these things in themselves are highly relative. Even one very careful thought about the world we live in will reveal to us that the conduct of the creatures of our own kind making up this world, this conduct is more unreasonable, more inconsistent, and more fantastic than a nightmare. Actually, the things that we accept and see and regard as realities because they are occurring in our physical experience, these things are many of them completely unreasonable, and as far as validity is concerned, they are not by any means actually true. Yet we have a kind of truth based upon external material experience. This kind of truth can be important, but only if we light it from within ourselves. On the other hand, we are not all consciously able to light it. We are not consciously able to take the things that happen to us and cause them to be the immediate conscious cause of growth. Nature is concerned with the advancement of lives, the advancement of the consciousness of being. Man himself lives for many years, sometimes an entire lifetime, without ever having truly accepted the challenge of the experiences which have occurred to him. He has passed through these things, he either has enjoyed them, or he has suffered because of them, and he goes no further in his estimation. He is definitely opposed to that which hurts him. He is definitely desirous of cultivating that which pleases him. And beyond these attitudes, there is very little logic. Actually, therefore, man's hope of gaining the necessary experience from action is that this experience be justly measured, weighed, and estimated by some faculty in man. Plato regards this faculty as the soul. That the soul, therefore, is the initiator. The soul is the power by means of which meaning, essential meaning, is contributed to experience. Now, essential meaning is very different from apparent meaning. For we can create and have created two kinds of code. One is the code of man, and the other is the code of God or nature. One may be regarded as the code of sacred things and the other of profane things. For the most part, man has not built his material way of life upon a divine code. He has built it very largely upon a pattern of compromises down through time. These compromises are never entirely satisfactory and are frequently the cause of his troubles. Yet there may be another code known to himself, whether he realizes that he knows it or not. And this is the code of inevitables as they exist in the larger pattern of life. There is a pattern of law that must be fulfilled. We may break all kinds of man-made rules and survive, but if we break this rule that is not made by man, but has an eternity in existence itself, if we violate that rule, then we come under serious difficulty. And nature will never rest until we have remedied this break and returned to a proper harmonic relationship with the essential pattern of life itself. The dream phenomena seems to have a bearing on this. It seems to be a way of bringing man back again to the responsibilities of his life. Where the conflict between the inner psychic nature and the outer conduct of man becomes too great, we may have definite indications of mental disease. This type of situation nearly always arises from some violent disturbance which has disrupted the natural order of life and has caused the individual to become too deeply involved in a pattern which is not essentially right. This pattern continues to hurt him and come in conflict with a pattern within himself which is essentially right. Thus there is a world pattern which we are all trying to live by, and an archetypal pattern which we must all live by if we intend to survive. These patterns are not identical, and the conflict between them represents the source of psychic stress. We know also that other things being equal, the sleep process is accompanied by a diminution of the entire excitation processes of the brain and central nervous system. Under sleep phenomena, we react less violently to stimuli of all kinds. There is a noticeable tendency for the heart to beat less rapidly. There is a very definite shift in the processes of metabolism. The metabolic processes slow down distinctly. We also recognize that there is a gradual separation of energy from the motor system, with the tendency of the body to become inert. We most of all notice, however, that this process gradually ends in the suspension of our objective mental functions. The study of sleep in animals and lower creatures brings some interesting information for our attention. Sleep as we know it, the kind of sleep that we have, seemingly is peculiar to higher forms of animal life. It is true that probably all creatures rest in some way. But as we go down the ladder of living creatures, we find more of rest and less of sleep. We find that the sleep process is not accompanied by the total extinction of consciousness that we find in man and the higher mammals. Thus, we observe, for example, that in the human body, in rest, metabolism also slows down, but not to the same degree that it does in sleep. Thus, it might conceivably be that lower forms of life might not require sleep, and that sleep as we know it is in some way a psychic necessity. That sleep, therefore, in the way that we experience sleep, is only possible to creatures, are only necessary to creatures, in whose lives or in whose experience there is a conflict between their way and the universal way. Animals and the lower kingdoms of nature particularly live in such a consistent adjustment with instinct that it is very rare indeed for them to violate it. Man is continually violating it, or has so reconditioned instinct that he cannot depend upon it. Thus, where instinct guides, where the creature does not come into any ordinary conflict with nature, apparently there is far less stress, far less wear and tear in the nervous system, and therefore far less need for sleep as we know it. Animals rest a great deal, but they have the wonderful habit of resting with one eye open. A cat will be very quiet, and you will think that it has been asleep for hours. But if there is the slightest indication of the unusual, a cat's eye slowly opens. It doesn't shake itself and wake up. It just simply has been kind of dozing. It has, however, never lost consciousness of its environment. The same is true of many other animals. Some animals sleep standing up, indicating that they do not need the total relaxation of the motor system that we have. An animal will stand with its foot in one position for hours. But at the slightest need, without any sense of awaking, the animal moves. It seems to be constantly aware of its own body and its ability to control its sensory functions. It can rest, it appears to relax completely, but it does not pass into this peculiar coma-like state with which we associate human sleep. Some of the higher mammals do sleep, but they are also the ones that are now being noted to possess neurotic tendencies. And as a result of association with man, for some time, a number of animals have become violently ill. There is now evidence that we may need to finally develop animal psychology. Not because the animal is of its own nature psychotic, but because experiments have shown that if you subject a rat to incredible wear and tear in the form of confusion, the rat will become neurotic and will begin to show all kinds of symptoms by which it becomes more intimately associated with the human type. What causes rats to become neurotic? Well, one of the things that causes rats to become neurotic is noise. Continuous noise. Seems to wear the poor little rodents completely out. Another thing that causes rats to be neurotic is the breaking of rhythms. If you place rats in a continually inconsistent situation, if you begin to feed them at strange and erratic times, if you, for instance, make a little house for them in which you have a door in a certain place, and you teach them to come in and out of that door, and after they've done it for 2 or 3 days, you close the door up and put it on the other side of the house, they'll adjust, but do it 4 or 5 times into different parts of the little house without any reasonable explanation, and the rat will begin to become neurotic. In other words, the animal becomes neurotic when it is placed in an inconsistent situation and subjected to unusual tension. Well, I would say that this could apply to our way of life and might have some way of explaining why we become neurotic. The rat becomes neurotic when it is disoriented, when it is no longer able to function according to its natural inclinations, or in which it develops various patterns and these are immediately violated. If there is a constant violation of law and order, the rat will become neurotic. And as it becomes neurotic, it produces a whole series of interesting phenomena. One of the sure proofs of neurosis in rats is that they suddenly get very tired. Neurotic creatures get tired. They do not get physically tired in the ordinary sense of the word. They become nervously exhausted. Thus, a neurotic rat needs much more sleep than a normal one. Also, its appetite change. The neurotic rat eats more. It becomes more and more dependent upon various forms of stimulation in order to keep its organism functioning. Its sleep apparently becomes a method of nature compensating for tension. This may well explain then why the human being and other higher animals require sleep. This sleep is a method of compensating for inconsistent action, or action which cannot be normally and properly planned for. It is a way of compensating for emergency, for stress, for any form of unusual activity suddenly thrust upon an organism. If the organism is placed in a new environment, it will adjust. If this environment is changed with reasonable regularity, it will continue to adjust. But if the changes are unreasonably rapid, the animal becomes neurotic. This may have something to do with our concept of progress, in which today values and securities are becoming so difficult to estimate, and life is becoming so hazardous in terms of relaxation and security, that the individual begins to follow the same neurotic tendencies as animals subjected to experimentation along these lines. Now, when you get to the point, then, where your sleep process begins to take over in a more or less consistent way as with us, it is natural that this sleep process should become increasingly necessary as certain types of stress become increasingly frequent or powerful. Sleeping and waking with man is obviously associated with the rhythm of the world around him. It has now been rather generally acknowledged that sleep phenomena is one of the legitimate links between man and universal phenomena. In other words, even the most skeptical thinker today is inclined to believe that sleep and waking are tied closely to the light-darkness phenomena of the solar system, and that night becomes a very important factor, not only because of darkness and of the limitations imposed upon the activities of ancient man, most of which, by the way, have now been neutralized, but night representing the loss of a kind of energy which is present during the daytime as one of the elements of sunlight. Therefore, the loss of sunlight becomes not only a symbol, but a factual loss in the vitality of the individual. That his vital elements, his vital resources, increase in daylight and decrease in darkness. But this is factual, because that light contains a stimulant, or a stimulating factor. This stimulating factor, being removed by darkness, or being obscured by darkness, seems to mean a distinct change in the energy vibration to which the individual depends for his survival. Let us try to analyze that just a little more, because it probably has a great deal of meaning. And as time goes on, this meaning may be more evident to more people. If you take away the objective consciousness of man, you then reveal something in man that is otherwise concealed. It is concealed because the objective consciousness is so positive, so aggressive, and so active that we are not aware of the passive processes. They are continuing, but we do not know that they are. Take away light from an area of the earth in the process of day and night, and you remove what might be equivalent to the objective energy of man. The moment you do this, another kind of energy, which has always been present, but which has not been noticed or realized, because the solar energy is far more positive, this other kind of energy begins to take over. And in the absence of the solar energy, this other energy is more immediately noticeable, and also is not counteracted or compensated for as it is in the daytime. In other words, the energy of darkness is not in a mysterious way overcome by the energy of light at night. Thus the sword of the sun ray no longer slays the dragon of darkness. And the struggle between light and darkness may be quite different from what we have mythologically considered it to be. Now, if you take away the solar light, what other energy do you release? Of course, the most common thought would be lunar energy, because in much of the night, the moon may be active. We know that the lunar energy is real because it affects the tide. But we also know that the lunar energy is inconsistent because the moon passes through phases. We also know that these phases are also marked in the psychic life of man, in the circulatory system, and particularly in the monthly cyclic periods of women. We know, therefore, that this lunar energy does have an effect. But this lunar energy, as we say, is also an inconsistent thing. So we may look for something even more basic. and we come to one almost certain and inevitable conclusion, namely that the earth itself has an energy, that there is a kind of vitality that moves outward from the surface of the earth, that the earth is a mysterious electrochemical structure, and that the earth does emanate a kind of energy. That this energy emanating from the earth was known to antiquity, we are certain. And we are also recorded for us, that this is a somatic energy, an energy which causes drowsiness, an energy which carries within it a very high psychic toxic content. That the earth energy, therefore, as it comes, is not as constructive or vital or helpful. And that this energy in particular has very little to contribute to the true psychic life of man. That the release of this energy may help to build up bodily structure is quite conceivable. Even as it is almost certainly true, and experiments in connection with treating tuberculosis by sunlight are a point in this, it is true that the solar energy is more stimulating, more irritating, and more involved in the processes of the central nervous system. In other words, the solar energy is an activating energy. The lunar energy is a periodic or cyclic energy, whereas the Earth's energy is one which is almost purely and completely physical, and therefore has its direct effect upon the physical organism. It is therefore quite possible that during night or during the sleep processes, part of the remedial agency accompanying rest is due to the fact that the Earth's energies, liberated from the domination of the solar intensity, this Earth energy does help to restore the material parts of the human constitution. This energy helps to nourish and feed those bodily factors and functions which are essential to survival. But this energy has very little part to play in the psycho-mental life of the human being. The energy of the earth, therefore, being what we might almost term a kind of toxic energy, may, when the solar energy is withdrawn, contribute toward the condition of exhaustion or the sense of physical weariness which associates itself with the processes of sleep. Sleep may then well be partly regulated by earth energy. During the daytime, activity being the victory of the solar energy over the earth's energy. But the earth energy is related largely to growth, whereas the solar energy is related largely to function. Thus, growth can imply or mean the restoration